A logo appears in bold, slanting letters over a blue planet in space. Turner. Now a logo of a thick-maned lion framed by a ring of film. Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. Titles appear in golden block letters. Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer presents a George Pal production. Now, in a black void, timepieces drift past as if in outer space. An hourglass follows a stone sundial. We see a pocket watch on its chain, then a marble base with three golden figures holding up a black orb. A small clock with an ornately engraved cabinet twirls, then a domed brass clock shoots by. A grandfather clock glides past us. The domed clock spins like a planet. Then other timepieces drift past. Now the Big Ben clock tower rises out of the night. Lightning flashes. A title appears. H.G. Wells' The Time Machine. Behind the letters, the sun rises quickly into the sky. Autumn leaves blow past as titles continue. Starring Rod Taylor, Alan Young, Yvette Mimieux, Sebastian Cabot, and Tom Helmore. This film is described for blind and visually impaired audiences by Descriptive Video Service, WGBH Boston. Described by Michael Braden. Read by Peter Haydu. Funded by the U.S. Department of Education. With Whit Bissell and Doris Lloyd. Screenplay by David Duncan. Based on the novel by H.G. Wells. Music score, Russell Garcia. In Metrocolor. Copyright 1960 by Lowe's Incorporated and Galaxy Films Incorporated. Director of Photography, Paul C. Vogel, ASC. Art Directors, George Davis and William Ferrari. Special Photographic Effects, Gene Warren and Hua Chung. Film Editor, George Tomasini, ACE. Directed by George Pal. Now at dusk, in Victorian London, a street lamp lights an icy sidewalk. A man emerges from a shop and hurries into a cobblestone street, where a bicyclist swerves to avoid him.
Excuse me, Mr. Philby.
Hunching in his overcoat, Mr. Philby continues across to a house set back from the street. Warm yellow light glows in the windows as he jogs up the front walk. Inside, an elderly housekeeper walks through the foyer to the door. Mr. Philby steps in with a polite nod and hands her his bowler hat, revealing neatly parted red hair. The housekeeper helps him with his overcoat and long scarf. He rubs his hands and blows into them, then proceeds through a wide doorway to a sitting room where he finds three men relaxing in armchairs by a hearth fire. Mr. Philby takes a seat. He shows an amiable grin under his trim mustache. A portly gentleman, the doctor, puts on pince-nez spectacles. Walter puffs a cigar, and Bridewell raises his brandy glass in a toast. All around the room, clocks of every description strike 8. The doctor checks his pocket watch, then puts it away and turns to Philby.
I say it's outright rude of the man.
He's merely being detained, that's all.
Oh,
this is such a confounded waste of time. If he's not coming, I have any number of more important things to do.
The gray-haired housekeeper enters.
Well, speak up. What is it, woman?
Passing the portly doctor, she hands Philby a note in an envelope and stands waiting as he reads it. Bridewell observes.
Well, are we or are we not invited for dinner?
Apparently we are. How long has he been gone?
Well, I can't rightly say, sir. Several days. I've hardly seen him for some time. And he never leaves the laboratory. Only comes in and picks at his food. But he did tell me about dinner tonight, sir, and left those instructions.
Thank you, Mrs. Watchett.
She leaves them.
Well, what does it say, Philby? What's wrong?
Oh, nothing really. George merely says that if he's not here by 8 o'clock, then we're to begin without him.
Walter, what time is it?
Walter starts to reach for his own watch, then glares.
Dinner is served, gentlemen.
That first sensible thing I've heard all evening.
They all stand.
This is peculiar. He's usually most prompt, precise, and punctual.
Oh, he's making fools of us by inviting us here and then not showing up. It's not the behavior of a gentleman.
To say nothing of the waste of time.
Huh? Yes, to say nothing of the waste of time.
There's one thing I like about old George. He's got the best cellar in the south of England. And Mrs. Watchett is the finest cook in the world. Yes, I think I'll drink to that.
Mrs. Watchett opens a door. A man's there. His clothes are torn and filthy, his face grimy. Everyone stares as George blinks and stumbles into the dining room.
Good Lord, what's happened?
He sinks into the head chair.
Some food.
A drink.
Bridewell offers his own glass, then pours himself another as George guzzles it down. George leans heavily on the table, his head bowed.
I didn't recognize.
Mrs. Watchett.
He touches her chin, then slumps back in his chair. His four friends stare at him.
Well, can't you speak, man? What happened to you? Aren't you
Leave him alone, can't you?
It's all right.
I've got to tell it now, David, while I still remember it.
Relax. Try to relax. You've all the time in the world.
George's gaze grows distant.
You're all right, David. It's exactly what I have. All the time in the world. Ever since we were together 5 days ago. The last day of 1899.
Now we see a small wooden box on the sitting room table.
There in that box rests the result of 2 years' labor.
The five friends gather for a drink.
I wanted to finish the job before the new century began. I barely made it.
George raises his glass.
Cheers, gentlemen. Marvelous, old boy.
Yes, but what is it?
Well, it has to do with time.
Oh, I've always maintained what this nation needs is a reliable timepiece. Navy needs one. Army needs one. For the artillery, you know.
Well, you couldn't do better, George. So that's why you've been in hiding, eh? That's very clever of you indeed.
I don't think George is referring to a new type of timepiece.
No, David.
George smiles.
When I speak of time, gentlemen, I'm referring to the fourth dimension.
David Philby nods.
Go on, George.
Well, the difficulty in explaining the fourth dimension is that it cannot be seen or felt.
If you don't mind, George, would you refresh me on the first three dimensions?
Oh, really, Philby? Surely they taught you something at school?
Suppose you explain it, Doctor.
Huh? Oh, suddenly.
The doctor stands.
Well, for example, when I move in a straight line, forward or backward, that's one dimension. And when I move to the left or right, two dimensions. And when I move up or down, three dimensions. For instance, that box. Well, that box has three dimensions, length, breadth, and height.
Yes, but what is the fourth dimension?
Oh, well, that's it. Oh, that's mere theory. No one really knows what the fourth dimension is, or even that it exists.
On the contrary, Doctor. The fourth dimension is as real and true a dimension as any of the other three. In fact, they couldn't exist without it.
What do you mean?
Well, let's take that box. It has the first three dimensions, as you said.
Oh, all right, but what's in that box?
I'm coming to that. Let's consider this first. Why is it that we usually ignore the fourth dimension? Because we have no freedom of movement within it. You see, we can move in the other three. Up, down, forward, sideways, backward, as the doctor said. But when it comes to time, we are prisoners.
George fixes his gaze on Bridewell.
Do you follow me, Bridie?
No.
Walter frowns.
George, you've given a most lucid explanation and all that, but I'm afraid I don't quite understand.
Walter, look, there are many things in this world you don't understand, aren't there?
Yes, quite a number.
Well, you don't refuse to believe in them because of that, do you?
No, not if I can see the proof with my own eyes.
Good, Walter. Gentlemen, all I'm asking you to do now is to witness a demonstration of the possibility of movement within the fourth dimension.
Trim and in his 30s, George approaches his ornately decorated box.
Doctor, could I have your help?
Oh, certainly, certainly.
The doctor holds the box, the size of a bread box, while George lifts the front top lid. Inside sits a contraption, scarcely bigger than a tree ornament. George takes it out and sets it on the table. 6 inches long, it resembles a sleigh with runners. Behind the single seat is a parasol-like disc mounted upright on its edge.
Oh, it's beautiful.
It's remarkable.
Very nice, George.
Fascinating. What is it?
This is only a small experimental model, of course.
He kneels.
To carry a man, a larger addition is needed.
To carry a man? Where?
Into the past or into the future? This is a time machine.
All right, George, now you've had your little joke, suppose you tell us what this contraption's really for.
I've already told you, Doctor. The larger model can be used to carry a passenger on a journey through time. Not through space, mind you, but through time.
I say, George, you're going to start floating about in the future. Aren't you going to rather mess things up for the rest of us?
No, the future's already there. It's irrevocable and cannot be changed.
I wonder. You know, that's the most important question to which I hope to find an answer. Can man control his destiny? Can he change the shape of things to come?
Oh, now, look here, George. If you've gone out of your head, I forgive you. But if you've made us waste all this time listening to you talk so much...
No, Doctor. You're here as witnesses. To see, not to listen.
To see? What?
The experiment I am about to perform. First, let me tell you how it works. Here, in this compartment, you see the saddle where the time traveler sits. And in front of him are the controls. Wait, let's do this properly. You can spare a cigar, I trust, Doctor?
George bends the cigar in two places and sets it on the red plush seat.
Let us imagine that this cigar is the time traveler. Now, in front of him is the lever which controls movement. Forward pressure sends the machine into the future. Backward pressure into the past. And the harder the pressure, the faster the machine travels. Of course, our little experiment can be performed only once. If it succeeds, I lose my model forever. That's why I need witnesses.
Go ahead, George.
You ready, gentlemen?
George reaches down for the tiny lever in front of the seat, then pauses.
Doctor, you can't lend me your hand.
Guiding the doctor's finger, he flips the lever upward like a light switch. The metal disc behind the seat spins and glows red. A light by the lever starts blinking. The doctor glances upward. The chandelier trembles. Bridewell notices the champagne bucket jiggling. David gazes down with wide eyes at the little model on the table as its 4-inch-wide disc spins. Walter frowns. The doctor cocks one bushy eyebrow. George watches intently. The model blurs, then fades away, leaving a yellow glow on the table. As George relaxes into a serene smile, the doctor shakes his head.
I'll be damned.
It worked.
But where did it go?
Go? Nowhere in the usual sense. It's still here. But it's no longer in the present. Do you realize? It's traveling through time. To the future, to be exact.
Do you really expect us to believe such a story?
Will you just... Well, certainly.
But you yourself just said that it hadn't really moved.
That's correct.
Well, then why can't we see it?
Because we're in this room on the 31st of December, 1899, but the model we just saw is perhaps 100 years away by now. This room, even this whole house, may not be here in 100 years. But the time machine occupies the same space that it did a moment before it went off on its journey.
Well, if it's occupying the same space, well, why can't I feel it?
You must remember that the space you're putting your hand through is today's space. You can't put your hand into the space of tomorrow.
Oh, the space is space. It doesn't change. The same space that's here now should be here in 100 or even 1,000 years.
No, Philip. time changes space.
Oh.
Look, this flat ground we're standing on could have been at the bottom of the sea a million years ago. And a million years from now, it could be the interior of a huge mountain.
All right. Suppose what you say is true. What do you expect us to do with such a contraption?
Contraption? For my part, I intend taking a journey into the future. Or perhaps the doctor would volunteer to go.
But look here, George. Supposing you do go off and get lost in the 50th century or something. How are you going to get back?
That's a risk I'm prepared to take.
Oh, now look here, George. I don't know what you take us for, but we're not fools, you know? We're practical men, businessmen. No, George, the question I want to put to you is this. Even if you had invented a time machine or whatever you call it, what of it? What use would it be to anyone? Who would want to buy it? And how much would they be willing to pay for it?
Yes, George, have you thought of the commercial possibilities?
No, I really haven't.
George, there's a war on, you know, in South Africa. The Boers are putting up a pretty stiff fight. No, George, the country needs inventors like you. Now, I can put you in touch with the War Office if you wish.
George blinks thoughtfully.
What do you think, David?
Oh, I think Dr. Hilliard has a good point, George.
Now we're becoming more sensible. I'll see to it first thing in the new year. Good Lord, it's your time to go, gentlemen.
Oh, yes, I'm sure we all have our plans for tonight.
Are you all right, George?
Yes, I'm all right, Bridewell.
Coming, Bridewell?
Bridewell gets his cape along with Walter and the doctor. George joins them at the door.
Thank you for coming.
Good night, George.
Happy New Year, George.
Happy New Century, George.
Good night, Brian.
The three top-hatted gentlemen stroll out into the snowy evening to a two-horse carriage waiting at the end of the walk. George stands in the doorway, watching as the driver snaps his reins and the carriage rolls away. Another carriage passes by, full of young men and women. In the doorway of the house, George bows his head, then turns with heavy steps and goes inside. He swings the door almost shut and stands wearily with his back to it. Clean-shaven, with a sharp nose and chin and short, neatly parted hair, he closes his blue eyes. He opens them with a faraway gaze, his mouth set in a grim line. Lost in thought, he takes a newspaper from a side table and starts up the stairs. He frowns at the paper and pauses after two steps. A headline reads, "Boer Army has won another victory." George's brow knits fiercely. Tossing the paper aside, he strides to a desk in the sitting room and strikes a match. Lighting an oil lamp, he quickly seats himself and finds a slip of notepaper. Then picks up his pen and dabs it into the inkwell.
George.
He looks up. David sits in a red leather chair by the hearth.
I thought I better stay.
George, wearing a dark blue suit and gray waistcoat, stands and paces toward his friend.
Well, you shouldn't have troubled yourself, David. I'm all right.
No, you're not. You've been behaving oddly for over a month now. I'm not leaving here until you tell me what's on your mind.
Look, David, I appreciate the gesture, but I just want to be left alone, that's all.
You've changed, George. Enormously.
I'm sorry.
George turns away.
Will you answer me one question, honestly?
Yes, I'll try.
Why this preoccupation with time?
Why not?
Oh, don't go simple on me, George.
All right, if you want to know the truth, I don't much care for the time I was born into. It seems people aren't dying fast enough these days. They call upon science to invent new, more efficient weapons to depopulate the Earth.
And I agree with you. I agree, George. But here we are, and we have to make the best of it.
You may have to. I don't.
All right. Take your journey on your contraption. What would you become? A Greek? A Roman? One of the pharaohs?
I prefer the future.
You're not seriously saying you can't do it.
David, you saw the experiment this afternoon, didn't you?
I saw a toy machine vanish. Certainly, there are any number of ways of doing that trick. Any magician at the Hippodrome could probably do it.
Wasn't a trick. Would you like to see the full-scale model?
No, I would not. I have no desire to tempt the laws of Providence. And I don't think you should. It's not for man to trifle with.
Oh, you're carrying on like Hillier and Kemp now.
There is something to say about their common sense attitude to life. George, I speak to you as a friend. More, as a brother. If that machine can do what you say it can, destroy it. Destroy it, George, before it destroys you.
You must have plans for New Year's Eve, David. Don't let me keep you.
Mary wasn't well. We thought we'd stay home with the baby. Why don't you come home with me? You haven't seen wee Jamie for a long time.
George starts to smile, then sobers.
I'm sorry I can't, David.
What's stopping you?
Well, look, I just want to see the old century out by myself. That's all.
Have it your way, George.
David catches sight of the empty wooden box.
George? Do you promise you'll not go out of the house tonight?
I promise you I won't walk out the door.
David frowns to himself, then turns away.
David, I'm sorry. Please don't think me unkind or unfriendly. Look, just come over to dinner next Friday, will you?
Very well.
Fine. Bring the others with you.
As you say, George. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, David.
They shake hands heartily. Then David turns and walks out to the foyer to get his coat. George stands still, watching and waiting as his friend bundles up in hat and scarf, then lets himself out. Returning to his desk, George rips the top page off a page-a-day calendar for 1900. He leaves through to January 5th, then dips his pen in the inkwell and writes on the small square page, "Dinner." Next, he writes on the slip of notepaper, inking his pen every few words. Mrs. Watchett lights the gas lamp chandelier in the foyer, then comes over.
Nothing's happening tonight, sir.
I don't think so, Mrs. Watchett.
Why don't you take the evening off and celebrate?
Well, thank you, sir, but if you're not needing me, I think I'll turn in early and get some sleep, if I can. Good night, sir.
Good night.
Oh, Mrs. Watchett, I've invited Mr. Philby and the others to dinner next Friday night.
Oh, yes, sir.
Happy New Year, Mrs. Watchett.
Happy New Year, sir. Happy New
Year! George slides the note into an envelope and seals it, then writes on the front. Getting up, he goes to the hearth and props the envelope against one of the mantel clocks. Now, wearing a plaid smoking jacket over his waistcoat, he strides through the dining room to a hallway where he unlocks a door to his laboratory. A full-scale version of the time machine stands in the middle of the cluttered room, 7 feet long, with a broad disc mounted in back like a fan. George approaches with a solemn expression, gazing at his creation. Encircled by a brass railing, the plush red velvet seat faces a cylindrical control console decorated with silver studs. Three lights, yellow, red, green, perch on top next to a single crystal-knobbed lever. George stands in front of the machine, tracing his hands along the curled brass rails supporting the console. He touches the lever, It shifts slightly. He detaches it from the console and frowns at the tip, then goes to a work table and puts it down. Taking a case of matches from his waistcoat pocket, George strikes one and lights a tall candle in its holder. He takes out his pocket watch and compares it to a clock on the work table. Picking up the 5-inch long time lever, he holds its tapered tip to a grinding wheel. He squints at the tip and smiles, then returns the lever to the console, carefully slotting it in place. Next, George examines the 5-foot-wide disc patterned with ornate designs. Straightening, he swallows hard, then raises a hinged section of the rail and slips into the seat. Settling back, he lowers the rail and gazes tightly at the console just before him at chest level. He takes a deep breath and flicks a few switches. A lighted display on the console reads, December 31st, 1899. George glances upward where a skylight's panes are lined with frost. He swallows once more, then grips the time lever and closes his eyes.
At first, I pushed the lever forward ever so slightly.
The disc starts to spin.
And the laboratory grew faint around me.
The skylight goes out of focus, then becomes clear again. The time display blurs. With his right hand, George grasps the lever and pulls it back toward him. The disc behind him slows to a stop, and he looks up at the window.
I stopped.
Dark blue clouds fill the sky. George frowns.
No change. Everything exactly as it had been before. But no, the clock said 6:31 when I started, and now it was 8:09. And the candle, shorter by inches.
He checks his pocket watch.
And yet by my watch, which was in the machine with me, only a few seconds had passed.
George smiles to himself, then replaces the watch in his waistcoat pocket and straightens up in the seat. He grasps the time lever and pushes it forward a few inches. As he watches, the candle on the work table burns down, and the clock hands spin more than an hour per second.
It was disconcerting to see the sun arc in less than a minute. To see a snail race by, my flowers flinging wide their petals to embrace the new day, and the hours speeding across the face of my sundial, and the flowers closing their eyes for the night. It was wonderful. Changes that normally took hours occurring in seconds.
Through a window, he sees a clothing shop across the street.
Dear Mrs. Watchett.
She eyes a display.
Always able to tell me what tie to wear, but never able to decide to wear anything more stylish than the type of clothes she has worn all these years. And as yet I was traveling very slowly. What if I went faster?
George reaches out and nudges the time lever forward. Overhead, the sun glides across a cloudy sky, then dusk turns the sky fiery orange. Stars wheel in their courses, then give way to a pink dawn, then bright blue daylight. The sun arcs from left to right, followed by the full moon, again and again in ever-accelerating passage.
It became intoxicating. Though I pushed the lever on toward even greater speed.
Day and night flicker across George's face. The console display counts the days, 6 per second.
As I went along, I gained experience in handling the machine. I found that I could stop for a day, an hour, or even for a second to observe.
A dress mannequin across the street.
Then go ahead a year or two. Thus, I was able to see the changing world in a series of glimpses.
The store mannequin wears a purple dress gathered up in front.
Good heavens. That's a dress?
This was intriguing. I wonder just how far women would permit this to go.
George pushes the lever forward. In the store window, a clerk appears several times and changes the mannequin's clothes in jerky, fast motion. Now the flashy outfits seem to change by themselves. Day and night flicker past as George stares in fascination.
I began to grow very fond of that mannequin. Maybe because, like me, she didn't age.
George looks through French doors at his small garden. On a tree, blossoms grow in seconds, followed by leaves and shiny green apples, which ripen to red.
Thirteen years have passed. 14, 15, 16.
Boards cover the windows.
And then suddenly the light was gone. What had happened? In the year of 1917, I stopped.
The spinning disc comes to rest, and George peers around the laboratory. He climbs out of the seat, then turns off the time machine. All around him, thick gray cobwebs cover the cluttered work tables and shelves. George goes to the door and struggles to unlatch it. Stepping down the hall and through the dining room, he finds a tangled mass of cobwebs covering the doorway to the sitting room. He parts the webs with his hands, spreading a cloud of dust, and ducks through. The armchairs lie draped in dirty sheets. Dust tarnishes the clocks on the mantel. George picks up a small one, looks at it, and blows on the top. A cloud of dust billows. He turns. Two mice scurry around a hole in the wall. George treads slowly across the room, looking around. He rests his hand on one draped chair, raising more dust. Continuing into the foyer, he goes to the front door and pulls it open. The doorway is boarded up with crisscrossed planks. George whacks one. It falls away and he kicks off three more. Stepping over the last one into bright sunshine, he wanders across the overgrown front yard. A bench lies overturned in the scrubby grass. A stone sundial sits askew. George straightens its narrow base and adjusts the circular face before moving on toward the street. A weathered fence with a few missing slats borders the yard with a sign, "Private property, keep out." George peers over it, then kicks off a couple of slats and squeezes between the rails. He wanders into the street, gazing about with a puzzled frown. To his left, an automobile approaches under a stone arch with an army officer in uniform at the wheel. George hops out of its way onto the far sidewalk in front of the clothing shop, Philby's department store. He stares at the auto, then catches sight of the young driver's shiny red hair.
Philby! Well, what are you doing, going to a masquerade party?
The clean-shaven man stares at him.
You look rather silly without your mustache, old man.
Were you addressing me, sir?
Philby, it's George! Well, I must say, I expected a little more enthusiastic a greeting.
I think you're confusing me with my father, sir.
Yes, there was quite a resemblance. I'm James Philby.
What? Were you a friend of father's?
Yes. Yes, I've been away.
He was killed in the war. A year ago.
George's gaze grows somber.
Oh. Oh, I'm so sorry. What about the gentleman across the street?
Oh, him. The inventor chap. He disappeared around the turn of the century. Look here, if you're interested in that house, sir, I'm afraid you can't buy it. Can't even get inside.
Why is that?
Well, my father was executor of the inventor's estate, and father just refused to liquidate it. I often chided him on that account, but he felt positive the owner would return someday. People hereabouts think it's haunted, but...
Philby squints keenly.
Who are you, sir?
George smiles.
Just a stranger who once knew your father.
Have you been at the front?
Front? What front?
Why,
the
The war, of course.
What war?
Good heavens. You mean you don't know we've been at war with Germany since 1914? I thought you'd just returned from France, perhaps. Or perhaps... perhaps a cup of tea might make you feel better, sir. Won't you come in? No, no, thank you. Are you sure you're all right, sir?
George takes a breath.
Yes, I'm quite all right. Then, goodbye, sir.
The young man turns away.
Goodbye, Jane.
Stopping at the door to the store, he glances back for a moment, then goes in, leaving George alone on the sidewalk. With his head bowed, George slowly steps into the street. An open-topped car cruises by. George vaguely watches it pass, then continues across to the weathered fence outside his dilapidated house. Stepping through the gap, he pauses, then strides around to the boarded-up French doors of his laboratory. He yanks down two of them, revealing broken window panes and a view from inside of Philby's department store. George peeks into his laboratory, then goes back to the front yard and hurries inside the house. Back in the laboratory, cobwebs flutter in a draft as George returns to his shiny, ornately detailed time machine. He steps over the brass rail and sits down, then flips the power switches and glances out the window at the store mannequin, which wears a sleeveless dress with a long pearl necklace and a feather-accented headband. As he pushes the time lever forward, the disc behind him spins faster and faster. Day and night flicker past at lightning speed. The ceiling window panes break one by one. On the console display, the year changes by the second. George gazes out at the mannequin, which wears below-the-knee hemlines and flashy hats.
Suddenly, in 1940, I began to be buffeted from side to side. My first thought was that the machine had a mechanical defect or a part had worn out.
In the sky, barrage balloons float on wire tethers. George pulls back on the lever, and the time display stops on June 19th, 1940. In a view over the city, spotlights crisscross the night sky. A warplane is hit.
The last time I had stopped was in 1917, 23 years ago, and the war with Germany was still waging. Now in the air with flying machines. Then I realized the truth of the matter. This was a new war. I decided to push on into time and see the outcome of this.
He pushes the lever and looks up at the explosions overhead.
Then my house was hit. The flames shot up into the sky and my home was gone in an instant. And I found myself in the open air.
The time display speeds through the months. Nearby, a modern building frame takes shape.
The years rolled by. Everything unfamiliar.
The mannequin wears a bikini.
Except the smile of my never-aging friend. But what was this? Weird sounds all around me. What could it be? My curiosity compelled me to stop.
The time display comes to rest on August 18th, 1966. George listens. The time machine sits on a neatly manicured lawn by the old sundial and a plaque on a base of clean stone. A crowd of people comes running past.
At first I wondered if my machine and I were the cause of the panic.
Men in gray uniforms waved the people on.
Well, I was soon to find out that we weren't.
Keep it moving here, shove it on.
People hurry past him, men wearing business suits and women in knee-length dresses. Stopped cars block the street outside the now high-rise Philby's department store.
Come on, into the shelter.
On his front yard stands the entrance to an underground air raid shelter. The townspeople disappear inside, leaving George alone. He approaches the sundial and plaque near a set of steps that leads to a lush park where his house once stood. The plaque reads, "This park is dedicated by James Philby to his father's devotion for his friend, George." George turns and meanders across the street. Nearby, a man and woman hurry away, weaving among the stopped cars. George finds himself on the sidewalk in front of Philby's department store, where a Red Cross sign is tacked on the door. An automated display shows a cutout man using an electric shaver. Now a real man in his 60s comes out of the store wearing a silver radiation suit.
Come on, young man, come on, come on! Philby? The name is Mr. Philby. And didn't you hear the air raid siren?
Well, you mean the horrible screeching?
It wasn't constructed for its aesthetic value, young man, but to warn silly young fools like you to get into the shelter. Now, come along, come along.
But I'm perfectly comfortable here, Mr. Philby. I've got to talk to somebody. This is fantastic. Your store is magnificent. The splendid achievements, the gigantic strides that mankind has...
Come along, young man, come along, come along. You'd better hurry or the mushrooms will be sprouting.
Mushrooms?
The wispy-haired man pauses and frowns at George.
You look familiar. Haven't we met somewhere before?
Indeed we have, Mr. Philby. Right there. Many years ago.
I was sure of that, but the exact time escapes me.
It was two wars ago. 1917.
Now I recall the chap who inquired about my father and the house that used to stand across the way. Oh, no. No, that's impossible. You haven't changed. You're not a day older. And your clothes...
Don't worry, Philby. It'll take a little time to explain, but you see...
That's the last alert. Hurry, hurry.
No, but listen, this is important.
Look.
A blip in the sky.
Atomic satellite zeroing in. That's important.
Mr. Philby grabs George's arm and tries to pull him, then lets go and runs away.
Philby!
Honey! Hi! Tilly, all clear!
But Philby, I've got to talk to you!
George watches the sky as he staggers back to the park. A distant explosion flashes bright white, and the department store's steel beams bend. George is thrown to the ground as an orange cloud engulfs the skyline. Nearby, a building explodes in flames. In the street, the earth cracks, shifting cars like they're toys. A brick wall topples. Dirt and debris fill the air.
The labor of centuries, gone in an instant.
George covers his head, then peers fearfully upward. Now a volcano spews ash and lava into the sky.
But then Mother Earth, aroused by man's violence, responded with volcanic violence of her own.
Gobs of molten orange rock spray up into the sky. A stream of flaming lava spreads through a grove of trees. Back at the park, George scrambles to his time machine and climbs into the seat. At the end of the rubble-strewn road, a lava flow approaches, bubbling as it fills the cracks in the bricks. The bright orange 2-foot-thick river advances slowly along the street, spreading around burnt-out cars and chunks of masonry. The cooling top of the flow bears along bits of flaming rock. A stone wall crumbles in its path. George shoves the time lever just as an orange wave engulfs the background. He covers his face, cowering in his seat as the wave gives way to a wall of rock surrounding him like a cave.
Only my speed through time saved me from being roasted alive and encased in stone forever. The molten rock cooled.
Shivering, George flips up his jacket collar. Beads of sweat glisten on his face as he folds his hands.
I prayed, wondering how many centuries, how many eons must pass before the wind and rain could wear away the mountain that enclosed me.
He reaches into his pocket and pulls out a case of matches. Lighting one, he reads the time display as it speeds through the millennia past 9,000.
Darkness. Darkness for centuries. I wondered if there was still war being waged on the ground above me, if man would still exist on Earth when I saw the sun again. The centuries rolled by. I put my trust in time and waited for the rock to wear down around me.
The walls crumble and fall away.
I was free again.
George smiles as the stones erode, leaving the time machine in a vast hilly landscape where trees grow before his eyes.
Thousands of centuries had passed, but the Earth had stayed green. There was no winter, no wars. Had man finally learned to control both the elements and himself? I had to stop and find out.
Stopping in the year 802,701, the machine spins in place, faster and faster. George is thrown from his seat, and the time machine comes to rest on its side in the grass. Later, after a downpour of rain, George wakes up.
But I'd stopped too fast.
A huge, sphinx-like statue head towers above him. George winces and struggles to his feet amid wisps of mist. Still wearing his dark blue plaid smoking jacket and navy trousers, he walks stiffly to the machine and pulls it upright onto its base. He turns and stares at the Sphinx statue, which rises from a bunker-like building of stone blocks 20 feet away. A path worn into the grass leads him to an inset panel, wide and split down the middle like a pair of doors. George pounds with his fist. Stepping back, he gazes upward, then returns to his time machine. He looks around, squinting in the sunlight. Through a break in the trees, he spots a dome-like building in the distance. George smiles and unscrews the time lever from the console of his machine. Hefting it confidently, he slips it in his trouser pocket, then heads into the dense, verdant forest.
Magnificent. Flowers, beautiful flowers everywhere. Natural splendor beyond compare.
He walks by pieces of a Greek-style pillar.
The whole landscape, one vast garden without any sign of weeds or briars. Trees and vines laden with fruit of strange shapes and colors. Nature tamed completely, and more bountiful than ever before. At last I'd found a paradise.
George pauses in his walk.
But it would be no paradise if it belonged to me alone.
Emerging into a clearing, he strides downhill across leafy ground cover to the edge of a dirt plain. Ahead of him, the giant round building stands nearly ruined. Ragged holes in the domed roof reveal a hollow, cavernous interior.
Unrepaired for centuries, maybe unlived in for as long.
George glances around him, then crosses the plain to a flight of broad steps at the dome's entrance. Scattered patches of weeds grow out of the weathered stone. George strides up, taking steps two at a time, then slows as he reaches the top. Facing him stand giant double doors with a round handle centered at chest level. George gently pushes it, and the left-hand door swings inward. Beyond the 20-foot-tall doors lies a giant open hall of round, neatly set dining tables. Each table displays a bowl of oversized fruit and about 10 place settings with smooth white bowls and goblets. George steps in and peers up at the half-destroyed dome above him. Leafy ivy climbs one of the support columns which ring the hall. Turning his gaze to one of the low, round tables, he picks up a dinner plate, then drops it back. George leans down and taps the plate against the table.
Anybody here?
He drops the plate onto the table. Turning, George heads back across the room to the giant double doors, gazing around him as he goes. After a final glance, he goes outside. Bright sunlight casts his shadow on the broad stone steps as George descends. Later, he makes his way through the forest, following a faint trail across a sloping meadow. Still in the gentleman's clothes of his time, smoking jacket, waistcoat, and trousers, he pauses at the top of a rise and frowns pensively as he gazes around. Later still, he pushes on through the forest, past trees bearing long, pendulous fruits. His troubled gaze darts left and right. His steps quicken. He finds himself in a glade of large, fern-like plants with spiky fans measuring 4 feet across. Overhead, the sun shines down through the trees. Sweat gleams on George's forehead as he presses on, striding faster and faster. He comes to a shady clearing and stops by a tree to catch his breath. Leaning heavily against the trunk, he bows his head. George's gaze lifts, searching. A faint smile touches his lips as he rushes forward through the trees. Stepping through a veil of hanging vines, he finds about 20 young men and women lounging by a river. All of them wear simple pastel-colored tunics. George smiles.
So this is man's future, to bask in the sunlight, bathe in the clear streams, and eat the fruits of the earth with all knowledge of work and hardship forgotten. Well, and why not?
A young woman struggles. George stares as she swept along the current. The young people on the bank take no notice as George sprints among them toward the water. The woman drifts toward a boulder and tries to grab hold as two young men sitting there simply watch her. Her fingers claw at the slippery rock. George stares around.
Just sit there, help her!
He takes off his jacket and dashes into the water while the others look on calmly. 20 feet offshore, the young woman slips under the surface. George swims powerfully toward her as the current sweeps her downriver. The young men on the rock turn to watch as the woman struggles, her bare arms flailing in the foaming water. George reaches her and gathers her in his arms. Other bathers watch from the shallows as he carries her onto the bank. With his clothes drenched through, George sets the woman on the sand. Water drips from her tight one-piece bathing suit. She sits limply with her head bowed. George picks up his jacket and places it around her shoulders, then gently lifts her chin and pushes her blonde hair from her face. She squints in the sunlight.
You all right?
Gazing flatly ahead, she abruptly gets up and walks away, holding the jacket close around her shoulders. George stares after her, then notices everyone else watching him. Two young women stroll past, then two men. As George looks on with a puzzled frown, the entire group gets up and walks away. Later, at the dome building, dozens of the young people, all blonde-haired, hurry up the stone steps, many of them in pairs, holding hands. George follows slowly as a few more wearing pastel tunics hurry past him. He pauses, then sits himself down on a step and slumps forward with his elbows on his knees. The young bather comes back down the steps, carrying George's jacket. Now wearing a pink, knee-length tunic, she ceremoniously holds out the jacket, and George takes it.
Thank you.
Why did you?
Why did I what?
Come after me.
Sit down.
The pretty young woman sits and gazes steadily at him.
I did it to save your life. That doesn't seem to mean much to you or anybody else around here.
It doesn't.
Do you realize there are about 20 of your friends watching you drown? Not one of them so much as lifted a finger to save you. It's a very curious attitude.
Two young men hurry past.
Very curious world. Aren't you the least bit interested in who I am? Where I come from?
Should I be?
George grins weakly and touches her arm.
I think perhaps you better take me to somebody a little older. Somebody I can talk to.
There is no one older.
You mean nobody ages in this land of yours?
She blinks her dark eyelashes.
Well, what's your name?
She smiles.
Weena.
Weena? How do you spell it?
Spell?
Spell, write. Can't you write?
George writes with his finger on the dusty step.
Weena.
Weena smiles shyly.
What are your people called?
Eloi.
George writes, E-L-O-I.
Eloi.
He taps a period, and she copies him. Suddenly, Weena turns and looks at the setting sun.
Come, we must go now.
Why? What's wrong?
It's getting dark.
What?
Taking his hand, she leads him up the steps to the giant double doors, which now stand open. Inside the domed hall, the other Eloi, all young and blonde, kneel around the tables to eat the large fruits. George stares around as Weena leads him to a table with two empty places. Slipping into his jacket, he kneels on a cushion between a young man and woman and grins.
Hello? I don't mind telling you, I'm quite hungry. I've come a long, long way.
He picks up a red berry as big as a grapefruit.
You know, in my time, a berry that size would have been big news all over the civilized world.
His companions ignore him and continue eating from their bowls of fruit.
Excuse me, sir. Sir?
He smiles at a young man with a bowl haircut.
Perhaps curiosity has died, perhaps even courtesy has died, but I have come a long way, and I would like to know a few things.
Why?
One of the other men glances briefly at him.
Well, because, I shall return to my time, and my people will ask me questions. Oh, such as, what kind of government rules your world?
We have no government.
Well, you must have a body of men who pass and enforce laws.
Laws? There are no laws.
Weena watches him as she eats.
Where do you get your food and clothing?
A man shrugs.
Doesn't anybody work?
No.
Well, where does all that come from?
It grows. It always grows.
Yes, I know, but it must be cultivated and planted and nurtured. Well, unless you...
Well, you mean you have an economy so well developed that you can spend all your time studying and experimenting, is that right?
You ask many questions.
George straightens and takes a deep breath.
Well, that is the only way that man has learned and developed. I wish to learn. I want to learn about you, about your civilization.
The man glances at him again, then away. George blinks and turns to another.
Perhaps you... Do you have books?
Books?
Yes, we have books.
Oh, wonderful. I can learn all I want about you from books. Books will tell me what I want to know.
Well, could I see the books?
The man gets up, and George follows him to a side room. Wearing a simple tan tunic, the young Eloi leads George to a shabby curtain hanging on a wall. Behind it lies a bookshelf filled with dusty, hardbound tomes. George takes one off the shelf and gingerly opens it. As he turns the pages, the stiff, yellowed paper crumbles in his hand. George's face hardens. He lifts his gaze to the Eloi man.
Yes, they do tell me all about you.
He shuts the book. In a cloud of dust, it falls to pieces in his hands. As the Eloy man watches, George turns and sweeps his arm across a row of books. They disintegrate.
What have you done? Thousands of years of building and rebuilding, creating and recreating so you can let it crumble to dust.
The young man stares at him.
A million years of sensitive men dying for their dreams. For what? So you can swim and dance and play.
Brushing the dust from his waistcoat, he storms out of the room and back into the domed hall where the Eloy laugh and talk. He points.
You! All of you! I'm going back to my own time. I won't even bother to tell of the useless struggle of the hopeless future. But at least I can die among men!
Turning, he storms out of the building and down the steps. Behind him, Weena stands in the doorway watching him go. Then she steps back and closes the door. Later, George heads back the way he'd come, striding across the sloping meadow in the dim light of dusk. In the forest, he hurries with his head down, past trees bearing pear-like fruit, then through a glade of flowering plants near the fragment of Greek pillar. As he comes out into the open, he stops and stares. His time machine is gone. Rushes across the grassy clearing to the huge Sphinx building. From where the time machine had once stood, two parallel track marks lead across the ground straight to the metal door of the stone building. Squatting down, George sees footprints in the dirt alongside the tracks. He straightens up, glaring at the wide metal door. His jaw clenches as he stalks forward. Suddenly, he charges and pounds on the door. He tries to pry the two halves apart, then gives up and looks around him on the grass. Finding a hefty stone, he raises it high. The stone shatters. George gazes up at the Sphinx statue, towering 50 feet into the sky with its stoic, angular features. Heaving a deep breath, George glances around him and spots a figure moving in the forest only a few yards away. The figure disappears. George frowns intently and slowly creeps toward the bushes at the edge of the clearing. He steps on a stick and freezes. Behind the bushes, the figure scurries away. We glimpse long white hair and a blue body. George cranes his neck to peer into the darkness, then resumes his careful advance toward the bushes. Crouching, he stares ahead with his hands at the ready. A few feet away, a dense bush obscures the blue figure as it moves. George pulls out his matches and strikes one. As it flares up, two blue figures scurry away. George blinks and shakes out the match. His nervous gaze scans the darkness of the surrounding foliage. Someone's there, behind a bush. George tenses. Stepping forward, he lunges behind the bush and pulls out Weena.
Weena, what are you doing?
I heard you pounding. I came to warn you.
Weena, how do you open that panel?
No one opens it. Only the Morlocks.
The Morlocks? Well, who are the Morlocks?
Weena nervously looks away.
Did they give us the food we eat and the clothes we wear? We must obey their command.
Why have they taken my machine? Weena, you've got to tell me.
It's night. We mustn't be out in the dark.
Only little children are frightened by the dark. And you are a little child, aren't you? Well, don't be frightened. I'll light a fire.
Please. Please let us go.
Rena, I can't. My machine is inside there. I've got to wait here till morning and find some way of getting it out.
No, you mustn't.
Come on. Help me gather some wood. Come on.
He takes Rena by the hand and leads her to where small sticks lie strewn on the ground. Quickly, he gathers a few handfuls into a pile. Rena collects some of her own and adds them.
That's a girl.
She kneels by the pile and watches him with a dimpled grin as he gathers more sticks.
Where are you from?
Well, as a matter of fact, I'm from right here.
He points to the middle of the clearing.
That's where my house used to be. Many thousands of years ago. See there?
She smiles at him.
From there up to those panels was my laboratory. And then beyond the panels is where my garden used to be. And right there, that was my library. Where I once sat talking with friends about the time machine.
He winces slightly, then sighs and resumes collecting sticks. He pauses again.
You know, Weena, I'd hoped to learn such a great deal. I'd hoped to take back the knowledge and the advancement that mankind had made. And instead, I find vegetables. The human race reduced to living vegetables.
A blue creature grabs Weena and drags her into the forest. George dashes after them and frees her. Weena wanders back to the clearing and George joins her.
They're gone. Are you all right?
The young woman sits slumped on the ground.
That was a Morlock, was it?
Yes.
Well, don't you worry. The fire seems to keep them away.
He lights the pile of sticks with a match from his pocket, then takes off his jacket and drapes it over her shoulders. Weena stares at the small fire and reaches out her hand. George snatches it away.
Why did you put your hand in the fire?
I never saw it before.
He rubs her smooth hand.
No knowledge of fire. No books, no. I'm terribly sorry. I'm sorry I was angry with your people. I had no right to be.
They hold hands.
No more than if I'd visited the island of Bali in my own time. But you know, Weena, you were safe inside your great house, and yet you came out into the night to warn me. The one characteristic which distinguished man from the animal kingdom was the spirit of self-sacrifice. And you have that quality. I think all your people have it, really. It just needs someone to reawaken it.
He smiles at her.
I should like to try if you let me. Will you?
I do not understand you. But I believe you.
It's as good a start as any. Try to tell me. The Morlocks. Who or what are the Morlocks? Are they animals or people?
Weena simply looks at him.
What about yourself? The past. Don't your people ever speak of the past?
There's no past.
Well, do they ever wonder about the future?
There's no future.
Well, the past. Man's past.
He puts his arm around her.
Is mainly a grim struggle for survival. But there have been moments when a few voices have spoken up. And these rare moments have made the history of man, man's past, a glorious thing. I refuse to believe it's dead and gone. We've had our dark ages before, and this is just another one of them. All it needs is for someone to show you the way out.
He kisses her head.
I'm only a tinkering mechanic, but I'm sure there must be this hidden spark in one of your people. If only I can kindle that spark, my coming here will have some meaning.
As they gaze into each other's eyes, our view glides down to the flickering fire. Daytime in a clearing.
My efforts next morning to open the panel were fruitless. I had to find another way to retrieve my machine.
George and Weena come upon a solid stone circle, 4 feet high and five across, surrounding a deep hole like a mine shaft.
Listen. Weena, you hear that?
She steps close to him.
Yes.
Machines?
No, Morlocks.
Wait, you mean those animals run machines?
They are Morlocks.
But have you ever seen the machines?
No, only heard of them.
Well, who told you?
The rings.
What sort of rings?
Rings that talk.
Could you show me these talking rings?
Weena nods. Later, they enter a stone-walled chamber with ancient artifacts on display, an Egyptian statue and a boxy metal device.
Come, this way.
Weena leads George by the hand past other exhibits of art and scientific instruments. On a low table, George finds a few shiny metal rings the size of bracelets.
These are the talking rings?
Yes.
They speak. Of what?
Things no one here understands.
Make it talk.
She spins one on its edge.
The war between the East and West, which is now in its 326th year, has at last come to an end. There is nothing left to fight with, and few of us left to fight. The atmosphere has become so polluted with deadly germs that it can no longer be breathed. There is no place on this planet that is immune. The last surviving factory for the manufacture of oxygen has been destroyed. Stockpiles are rapidly diminishing, and when they are gone, we must die.
The ring lies flat on the table. George picks up another one and sets it spinning.
My name is of no consequence. The important thing you should know is that I am the last who remembers how each of us, man and woman, made his own decision. Some chose to take refuge in the great caverns and find a new way of life far below the Earth's surface. The rest of us decided to take our chances in the sunlight, small as those chances might be.
From the talking rings, I learned how the human race divided itself and how the world of the Eloi and the Morlocks began. By some awful quirk of fate, the Morlocks had become the masters and the Eloi their servants. The Morlocks maintained them and bred them like cattle, only to take them below when they reached maturity, which explained why there were no older people among them. Now I knew I must go below. It was the only means of finding a way up into the Sphinx to reach my machine and find out what happened to the little people when they did go below.
Don't go.
Back at the sandy clearing, George kisses Weena's cheek, then peers down the shaft. He climbs onto the smooth round wall, then lowers himself down into the hole.
You won't come back.
I'll be back.
She offers him a small pink flower. He stows it in his breast pocket and starts his descent. Now at the Sphinx, 8 spikes, like missiles, rise up from below the statue head. Weena stiffens.
Weena?
In a trance, she walks away.
Weena!
George climbs back up the rungs set into the rough walls, bracing himself against protruding rocks. Reaching the top, he jumps out and stares around. Meanwhile, Weena walks stiffly through a glade of tall grasses, her eyes fixed forward and her face expressionless. Other Eloi pass in the distance, heading in the same direction. George reaches the glade and stops.
Wina!
He dashes after the Eloi.
Wina, answer me! Where are you?
At the domed building, dozens of Eloi emerge, marching slowly in rows. Staring straight ahead, the young men and women descend the broad stone steps. In the forest, George finds more Eloi trudging with the same stiff gait in their thin, flimsy tunics. He confronts one of the young men.
What's happening?
He grabs another. He sprints past a long line of Eloi.
Wina! Wina!
He scans their similar clothes and blonde hair, then dashes forward along the line after a woman wearing a pink tunic.
Wina! Wina, stop!
He grabs the woman. It's not Wina. George stares frantically around, then hurries away as the Eloi converge at the clearing in front of the Sphinx head. Walking in ragged single file, they approach the panel doors at the base of the building, which now stand open. George grimaces and covers his ears against the sound.
Wina!
He stumbles forward along the line of Eloi toward Wina, who's nearly at the Sphinx. As more Eloi enter the dark chamber beyond the doors, the siren spikes on top retract, and the doors start to close, with Wina inside. George reaches them just as they slide shut. The Eloi still outside come out of their trance and start to walk away.
Stop!
They stare at him.
Well, what happens to them? Don't stand there like fatted cattle, will you? Answer me!
He grabs one of the young men.
What is wrong?
There is nothing wrong.
It is all clear.
George frowns.
What do you mean, all clear?
All clear.
The middle 1900s, the falling bombs, the people calling out, all clear. No, that's gone, that's past. There are no more flying machines, no more bombs, no more wars.
The rings have told us that story.
But you didn't listen. You didn't learn anything. It was ages ago that men were taught to hide below the ground when the sirens blew, to run from the raining death, but it's over. Those men are dead. The men who slaughtered them are dead.
But there is nothing to fear. It is all clear.
What about the ones who went below? How do you think they're gonna come back?
They never come back. Nobody can bring them back.
You can try. You can try. Won't even one of you try!
Most of them turn and walk away.
Well, I'll try.
George hurries off to the sandy clearing where strange, stunted trees poke up from the sun-baked sand. At the shaft opening, his forgotten jacket lies draped over the edge. Two more openings jut up several yards away. George climbs over the edge and lowers himself down into the 5-foot-wide hole. He slips, then gains his footing on the ladder rung set into the side. As he begins his descent into the darkness, 5 or 6 Eloi up on the surface approach the shaft. George slips again and clings to a ledge by his fingertips. Later, George carefully descends from ledge to ledge. He drops down to a stone floor and crouches alertly. Glancing back up the shaft, he spots 2 Eloi peering down at him from the top. George squints around in the dim light. Noticing several sticks lying nearby, he picks up a stout branch and breaks off a 2-foot length. He takes a handful of wispy moss growing out of the wall and wraps it around one end of the stick. Nodding to himself, he gets up and advances warily toward the mouth of a gigantic underground cavern. Around a corner of rock, two figures with shaggy white hair disappear behind a complex of steam-emitting machines. George treads forward carefully, wielding the stick like a club. He leaps from a high platform to a ledge winding along one wall. His shirt grimy with dirt and his waistcoat partly unbuttoned, the strong-chinned inventor creeps along the wall. He passes three squat pipes which rise from the ground, each with a series of concentric blue rings encircling its top. Steam drifts into the air. George clenches the stick in his hand as he reaches the entrance to a side chamber. Stepping in, he stares.
So this was the destiny of the Eloi.
Human skeletons.
They were being bred by the Morlocks, who had degenerated into the lowest form of human life. Cannibalism.
George swallows hard and turns away. A Morlock follows him along the edge of the main cavern. Similar to a stocky human, it has blue skin, shaggy white hair, and glowing eyes. It wears a rough loincloth and stoops its broad frame as it moves. A vertical pipe rises along the rock wall like a downspout. Clear liquid pours out the bottom into a small basin. George hops lightly over the flow and continues down a set of steps hewn into the rock. As he approaches one of the machines in the middle of the cavern, he pauses. His eyes dart alertly under his neatly parted hair. Behind him, two Morlocks watch. George spins around, and they're gone. He wanders across the central cavern, creeping around dark gray boulders and refinery-like metal rigs which jut up from the ground. He jumps up onto a platform near the squat pipes leaking steam. He pauses to stare at them, then scans the cavern. Behind him, a Morlock's hands reach for his neck. They withdraw. At the entrance to the cavern, other Morlocks crack whips as the Eloi file in. George hides behind a boulder, then peers out and spots Weena among the entranced prisoners. As the two dozen Eloi shuffle across the clearing into the bone chamber, George dashes out of hiding, grabs Weena, and hustles her behind a boulder.
Weena, wake up! Come to your senses, all of you!
Morlock's whip wraps around his neck. George yanks on it, and the burly Morlock tumbles to the ground. Taking the whip himself, George attacks the half-dozen Morlocks throughout the cavern, while the Eloi huddle together by the entrance to the bone chamber. A Morlock jumps on George and knocks him to the ground. George covers his face from their lashings. Behind him, the Eloi retreat into the chamber and slide a curtain across the entrance. The Morlocks send George scrambling to join them. Outside the curtain, the Morlocks close in, with their hulking bodies, protruding teeth, and pinpoint eyes. George holds Weena close. Then he reaches into his pocket for a match, lights it, and thrusts it into the Morlocks' faces. Light floods our view. The Morlocks shield their eyes and back away. George holds the match high and slowly steps outside the curtain. The match burns down in his hand. He tosses it away and the Morlocks advance on him. Standing his ground, George strikes a new match and holds it up. They back away again. One Morlock charges him. George darts away and finds the stick he dropped. Weena runs to him as he strikes a match to light the moss.
Burn. Give me something to throw, that's my last match.
Weena tears off a piece of her sleeve. George lights it, and the moss bursts into flame.
Good girl.
Wielding the torch, George turns to the Eloi.
Get up the stairs! That's the way out! Quickly!
Many Eloi hurry away. George swings his flaming torch at the Morlocks, but a whip flings the torch from his grasp. The Morlocks close in, and George fights them barehanded. He pounds one of them in the belly, then drops it with a fist to the jaw. Scampering away, he confronts another Morlock, floors it with one punch, and swings around a pipe rig to kick two others in the chest. Hurling another Morlock to the ground, he flees, but finds himself cornered at a rock wall. He leaps onto a higher platform, then ducks under a Morlock's grasp and lunges onto a narrow stone ledge. From the middle of the cavern, Weena watches George fight off one Morlock and struggle with another. High on the ledge, George clings to the creature's waist. He grabs its shaggy head and whacks it against the wall. Throttling its neck, he pounds it on the chest, and the beast plummets to the ground. George leaps to another ledge, then spots his torch on the ground, still burning.
Torch! The torch!
Two Morlocks close in, and he fends them off with fierce punches.
Weena, get the torch!
Weena sees the torch on the ground by a boulder. She bends to get it, but a Morlock challenges her. It picks her up and carries her away. George pulls Weena free and punches her attacker in the face. Another Morlock tackles George to the ground. The remaining Eloi watch helplessly as the Morlock chokes him with its claw-like hands. One of the young Eloi men slowly curls his fingers into a fist, grimaces, and beats on the Morlock's back. George kicks it against a rock, and the creature slowly slides to the ground. Blood spurts from its mouth. George staggers to his feet and gets his torch as three Eloi men grab a Morlock.
Come on, up the steps! Hurry up! Come on, hurry!
The two dozen Eloi run up the ledge toward the platform. Weena and George bring up the rear. Three Morlocks chase them, shielding their eyes. George pauses by the downspout pipe.
Come on, Weena!
He touches his torch to the flowing liquid, and the basin erupts into flames. On the ledge, an Eloi man shoves a Morlock out of his way. Another Morlock falls into the burning basin. The flames spread across the cavern to the pipe rigs. One of them ignites in a blast of smoke, engulfing a Morlock in flames. The creature panics, waving its burning arms as it staggers around and blunders into the bone chamber. A cloud of smoke spreads through the cavern. Meanwhile, the Eloi reach the bottom of the shaft ladder and start their climb up through the narrow hole toward the surface. Back in the cavern, flaming debris falls around George and Weena as they catch up. Above ground, the first Eloi prisoner climbs up out of the shaft opening, followed by others. Down below, George and Weena escape the red glare of the cavern and start to climb up the shaft. Their clothes are covered in dirt. George supports Weena as she grips the ladder rungs. Up at the top, the Eloi emerge from the shaft one by one. Below them, the shaft walls glow fiery red as George and Weena climb. Finally, they reach the top amid a cloud of yellow smoke. Several Eloi help them. One man takes George's hand and pulls him out, and the two share a relieved grin.
All right, gather all of that wood. Come on.
The Eloi spread out.
That's fine.
They gather sticks and throw them down the shaft.
All the dead wood. Fine. Throw it down. Do the same to the other well. All the wood down the well.
George peers down the shaft and sees the sticks burning fiercely. He and Weena back away. A fireball spews up from the opening. He and the two dozen Eloi run away across the sandy clearing. Now at the domed building, the free Eloi come outside as smoke fills the air. They stare and point into the distance, while at the clearing, four more shafts erupt like volcanoes. The entire clearing sinks, collapsing into the cavern beneath it. An explosion flares. Smoke billows into the sky. In the forest, George smiles.
All right, let's go!
He and Weena hurry away with the rest of the freed Eloi.
Another night was coming, but this night, no Eloi needed to fear.
Later, at the river.
The underworld of the Morlocks was gone. And so was the life of leisure for the Eloi.
Weena brushes dirt off her arms.
But then what of me? I was imprisoned in a world in which I just did not belong.
She gazes at him.
Are you sorry?
Sorry? Sorry for what?
That you have to stay.
Yes. I'm sorry because I could tell so much to the people of my time, Weena. I could let them know about the sorrow and the happiness that the future has in store for them. Maybe they could learn from it. Or could they?
He bows his head.
You don't want to stay, do you?
Oh, it isn't that. Just that I don't really fit here any more than you would in my time.
I would love to see your time.
Mm-mm. You wouldn't be very happy there.
Do you have someone there? Someone like me?
No, no one like you. I have friends, of course, friends who'll miss me. As a matter of fact, I'm probably late already.
Women?
No.
Weena smiles shyly.
As a matter of fact, there is one woman. But she looks after my house for me, and she's 62 years old and all wrinkled and nothing like you.
The young woman touches her golden hair.
How do they wear their hair?
Who?
The women of your time.
Up.
Up? Up how?
George twirls his finger above his head.
I don't know, kind of up like that.
Show me.
George's smile fades. Gazing intensely, he kneels next to Weena and brushes back her lustrous, shoulder-length hair. She stares into his eyes, her lips parted slightly.
Would I be pretty?
Yes, you would. Very pretty.
Their lips nearly touch.
Oh, Weena. I wish we could go back to my time. Or even to the time before that when the world was young. We could be very happy.
Look! Look!
Several Eloi run over, pointing behind them. George and Weena run back with them to a smoke-filled clearing where a man points again.
Look!
The Sphinx is half burned away. Everyone runs over to the stone building where the panel doors stand wide open, revealing the time machine.
My machine!
George gets out the lever. He dashes into the dim chamber where his time machine sits, still intact.
Weena!
Weena starts forward, then stops. The doors close. Weena runs up to them and smacks them with her hands. Inside the chamber, George tries to pry the doors apart. Weena sinks to the ground in tears. Two Eloi men rush forward and pound on the doors. Inside, George turns and sees two Morlocks shuffling toward the time machine. He dashes over and jumps into the seat, kicking away one beast and punching out another. The first Morlock attacks again and George shoves it away. Its head bangs against the wall and the Morlock lies still. He fends off the other Morlock. As it falls away, George pushes the time lever ahead and the disc starts to spin. Breathing heavily, George clutches his right shoulder. His pained gaze fixes on the dead Morlock. Its hideous face decays rapidly. An eyeball falls out, and the long white hair thins away until only a bleached white skeleton remains. The skull falls off, and the bones disintegrate. Suddenly, George stares at his console.
I was going the wrong way. Back. Back. I had to go back.
He slowly pulls back on the lever with both hands, then watches the time display as it counts down. Past the year 700,000. Then 600,000. George slumps in his seat as the world changes around him. The tomb of volcanic rock melts away in a blur of orange, revealing trees in the open air. George's shirt is filthy and torn. Slouching wearily, he holds the scrape on his shoulder. Outside the time machine, his own garden cycles through the seasons. Clouds flash past through night and day. George blinks and glances upward uncertainly. As the year drops to 1909, he grips the lever and nudges it forward. The disc behind him spins slower and slower, and the time display stops at January 5th, 1900. George lets go of the lever and looks around. He's back in his garden. He clambers out of the time machine and leans over wearily. With a relieved smile, he staggers to the French doors of his laboratory and tugs on the handles, but they're locked. Looking around, he sees a pile of firewood stacked nearby. He takes a piece off the top and smashes a door pane, then reaches through, turns the handle, and pulls one of the doors open. His head lolls in exhaustion as he pauses in the doorway. Then he strides unsteadily across the room to the inner door, unlocks it, and enters the house. Later, in the dining room, George sits at the table surrounded by his friends.
Well, it's the most ridiculous story I've ever heard. Absolutely preposterous.
Well, there's one thing I'll say for old George. You always could tell a good yarn. You're a truly great inventor, George.
I think you ought to retire, sir.
Truthfully, George, where have you been the past week?
Now, you shouldn't ask such questions, Walter. It's not hard for a man to lose a little week now and again.
I can understand your doubt, my friends. Take it as a lie if you wish. I scarcely believe it myself now that I'm back.
George reaches into his breast pocket and brings out the pink flower.
David, there's the flower Weena gave me. David, a present for you. You were always interested in botany. Try and match that with any species known today.
David Philby takes the flower and studies it with a frown.
I don't think I can.
The doctor downs the rest of his drink.
Well, time to go, Bridewell.
Huh? Oh, yes, it is getting late.
Good night, George.
Good night, George. Good
night. They all get up from the table. Walter faces his friend.
You look exhausted, George. You really should get some rest.
George looks at the floor. David walks past, then pauses. With a thoughtful nod, he smiles faintly and leaves, holding up the pink flower. Meanwhile, the doctor and the others step out into the snowy night. Bridewell stumbles. In the doorway, David dons his coat and scarf, and George shakes his hand.
Good night, George. It's grand having you back. Goodbye, David.
David's grin fades. Turning, he throws his scarf over his shoulder and heads away.
Thanks for being such a good friend, David.
Always.
David frowns, glances back at his friend, then walks away. Left alone, George shakes his head and closes the door. David joins the doctor and Walter at their carriage.
What do you think, Philby?
One thing is certain. That flower couldn't possibly have bloomed in the wintertime.
Well, you don't really believe that story's true, do you?
Good night.
He shuts their door.
Go on, driver.
The one-horse carriage pulls away, leaving David Philby standing alone as thick snow falls. David turns back and trots up the walk toward the house. Out in the rear garden, George drags his time machine across the snow toward his laboratory. Meanwhile, David enters through the front door. Removing his bowler hat, he strides through the sitting room to the dining room.
George!
He turns back and glances around the room with a frown. Stopping, he gapes, then dashes through the dining room and down the hallway to the laboratory door. It's locked. Mrs. Watchett comes running as David shoves the door open. The lab is empty.
Mr. Philby, what?
He's gone.
Hello?
Tracks in the snow lead to the open French doors, ending in scratched lines at his feet.
I think I understand. You see the imprint? This is where the time machine originally stood. But the Moorlocks moved it. They dragged it across the lawn, right into the Sphinx, right there. And Weena was standing here when he last saw her. Right here, the same space in a different time. So he dragged his heavy machine back in here, scratching the floor, so that he could appear outside the Sphinx again and help the Illoi build a new world. Build a new world for himself.
Right where he left her.
Yeah.
Smiling to himself, David turns and accompanies Mrs. Watchett back to the library.
It's not like George to return empty-handed, to try to rebuild a civilization without a plan. He must have taken something with him.
Nothing.
The old woman's gaze fixes across the room on the bookshelves above George's desk.
Except three books.
Which three books?
I don't know. Is it important?
Oh, I suppose not. Only, which three books would you have taken?
David steps into the foyer.
Mr. Philby, do you think he'll ever return?
One cannot choose but wonder. You see, he has all the time in the world.
Mrs. Watchett opens the door for him, her brow creased. David takes a step outside. Still smiling, he wraps his scarf snugly around his neck, settles his hat on his wavy red hair, and heads off into the night. From the front step, Mrs. Watchett gazes after him through the thickly falling snow, then closes the door. The warmly lit windows darken one by one. Fade to black. A title card appears. H.G. Wells' The Time Machine. The End. Made by Galaxy Films Incorporated. Released by Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer.